Okay. So this is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for July 31st, 2019. And I guess the first order of business is to approve the minutes from last month. Are there any objections to approving those as they were sent out? Okay. Hearing no objections, we'll consider those approved. And the agenda, are there any objections or amendments being proposed to the agenda for tonight? Okay, this is going really well so far. Great. So that's the agenda's approved. So now we go to our first item on the agenda. And it's Christopher Bolin, and I believe, Sherry, you are going to introduce Christopher.
Yes. As we probably all know, Christopher Bolin is a man of incredible integrity, courage, one of the most amazing patriots I happen to know, and I feel honored to know him. He's an investigative journalist that just happened to be going through New York at the time, and he was hired to cover that story. And some amazing things happened from that moment forward in his life that brings us to today. He's written two books on 9/11, and he's also traveled extensively all over the world discussing the crime of 9/11 and putting up with quite a bit. And he's just I can't say enough about him. He's just an amazing man, and I just feel honored to know him, and he's been keeping up on all the stuff that's going on with our government and Mr. Trump, and especially the Zionists that are controlling our government right now. Mm-hmm. And I would, without further ado, I would like to turn this over to Mr. Christopher Bolin. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Sherry. That was a good introduction. Okay. Can you hear me all right?
Yep, loud and clear.
Yeah. Okay, very good.
Perfect.
Yeah, my name is Bolin, B as in boy, O-L-L-Y-N. My website is bolin.com, and I also post my ideas on Facebook under my name. And I've written, as Sherry said, several books about 9/11. There's a set of books called Solving 9/11. The main book is The Deception That Changed the World, under the Solving 9/11 title. And the second book is Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. And right now I'm working on volume two of that because those books are written in 2012. And so since 2012, there are 7 years of articles to go into a volume two of original articles. And that will be released on September 11th this year. So it's great to be with you all because it gives me an opportunity to flesh out my current ideas about 9/11 and our political situation that it puts us in. The 9/11 cover-up is worse than the crime itself. Now, as awful as 9/11 was, as horrible as the crime it was, what's even worse is the cover-up by our government and media. And the reason why it's worse is because it tells us, it indicates that our government is corrupted and controlled by the people who carried out 9/11 itself.
Yes.
That means Donald Trump. That means the Congress. That means the court system. That means the mainstream media, New York Times to San Francisco Examiner, all across the country. So those of us who have studied 9/11, understand that there's a cover-up. Now, it's not everybody in America understands there's been a cover-up. There's a lot of people, of course, who believe the official story or, for convenience sake, go along with the official story and don't question it. But those of us who are 9/11 activists, if you will, know there's been a cover-up and know how the cover-up has affected our government. For example, we've seen the reports by NIST that fail to even look at evidence of explosives or molten metal in their investigation of what happened to the Twin Towers. So there's clearly a cover-up going on. But as I said, as bad as 9/11 is, the cover-up is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worse because it's an ongoing crime. That is to say that it's been going on since day one. There are people in the government and there are people in the media who control what goes. And that these people have omitted information from the record, from the official government record, from the press. So that, for example, you have not read in the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune anything about the molten metal that poured off the 81st floor of the South Tower for 7 minutes before it collapsed. You have not heard about the molten metal at the base of the World Trade Center at 3 weeks after, 4 weeks after the event itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that the cover-up has corrupted our government and put it, our government, in the hands of the culprits of 9/11.
Yeah.
That's important to understand. That's important to understand. That means that from George Bush to Barack Obama to Donald Trump, the culprits control the White House. They control, therefore, the executive branch of the government. They also have a great deal of control over the legislative branch, Congress, and judiciary as well. So what they're doing right now is in this extended political campaign that we see in America that lasts for 2 years or more, they're now throwing in a lot of smoke bombs, pseudo-issues, issues like, you know, ongoing issues like race and gender and sexuality and all these various things that really don't matter. I mean, of course race matters and gender matters, but it's not, that's in itself not the problem. How a person is treated or abuse of people, that's important. So why are they doing that? They're creating all these smoke bombs so that they have a something to obscure 9/11 truth with, because the most important subject on the table in these debates should be, of course, 9/11 truth.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody is telling those congressmen and those political candidates and those senators, you will not talk about 9/11. You will not talk about 9/11 truth at all. Silence. Mm-hmm. And this order has gone through. Now, how do we identify, well, this is the good thing, is that although this is so terrible that our government is in the hands of the culprits, it gives us an opportunity to identify who the culprits are. Because the people who are covering up 9/11 are in cahoots with the 9/11 culprits themselves. It's part of the same team. Because the only people who benefit from the cover-up are the guilty parties involved in the 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at it on a local level, like New York City, there's been a cover-up in New York City for 18 years now, almost 18 years. But the people are very quiet about it. If you go to the New York fire departments, if you go to the police departments, if you talk to the local people who are obviously involved in this, first responders, they won't talk openly about being told to shut up, but you can get it from them, and if you know them personally, you'll find out. They'll tell you that so and so told me, or we were told, not to talk about 9/11 at all. And that's been a who did that? Well, in the case of New York City, we know who was running New York City for the first 12 years of the cover up, and that was Michael Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Michael Bloomberg and Michael Bloomberg's city government, people in that government, and himself, who are obviously responsible for putting on the gag order on all of the first responders and the police and the firefighters. And this is very serious because, of course, you know, in New York City, you have thousands of people coming down with new ailments and sicknesses every month due to their exposure.
Yeah. Right.
So the exposure is a big issue. But that's what I wanted to say is that somebody, some network is telling the people in our government, in the U.S. government, in the executive branch, in the legislative branch, to shut up about 9/11. And the good news is that I will work at identifying this network. I will find some congressman or somebody who will tell me, yes, I was told by so-and-so in no uncertain terms that my political career would be over if I discussed 9/11 truth. Now, the thing is, of course, it cannot be that all 475 members of Congress are all reading or believing from the same page that 9/11 was done by Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and all those people. It can't be. In this day and age, 18 years later, with all the evidence, all the information out there, there must be in Congress some people who know deep in their heart and in the recesses of their own brain that 9/11 is a lie, but somebody has told them, you won't talk about that if you want to remain in power or if you want to stay alive. So that's why I've been focusing so much lately in my postings and discussion about the cover-up, because the cover-up, like Nixon said, it's not the crime that gets you, it's the cover-up. Because in the cover-up, you cannot apply a cover-up to such a thing like 9/11 without exposing yourself. So we know who owns the media, we know who runs the president, we have some idea of who runs the president, we know who has power in Congress. And if you look at it like right now, Donald Trump's been in power for 30 months or so. He dangled this fruit in front of the American people, in front of the voters, that if I get elected, you will find out who took down the World Trade Center.
Yeah,
and he's even said more recently he said something like, I know who did 9/11. You may also know who did 9/11. And he's teasing us with this. He's teasing the 9/11 truth community and the voters with this idea that he knows and he will reveal at some point who did 9/11. But he hasn't done so yet. Now, a lot of people think that this is just five-dimensional chess, and he knows who did 9/11, but he plans to reveal them, but he won't do it yet. Well, I don't know. By his actions, we can see that what he has done for the first 30 months is basically work in service to the State of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu. He has done everything that the radical Zionist agenda calls for. Recognizing Jerusalem as a state of the capital of Israel, annexing or recognizing the illegal annexation of the Golan Heights, waging an economic war against Iran, and continuing the wars in Afghanistan and Syria and Iraq. So the war agenda has gone on despite his instinct to stop it, and he's taking us to the brink of a war with Iran. With his embargo, with his punishing sanctions on Iran. So we see that on one hand, he is doing everything to serve a foreign state, Israel. And on the other hand, he's not doing anything about 9/11 truth. So if you just think about it logically, these are two sides of the same agenda. The diktat that he's been given, the diktat that he's gotten from his masters, is the same diktat that Congress has gotten. You will support the Israeli agenda 100%. You will never vote against Israel on any matter, even if they're shooting kids through the fence or what have you, even if they're bulldozing and dynamiting homes. I don't know if you saw recently there was a large building in the West Bank that the Israelis blew up, and it looked very much like what happened to Building 7 on 9/11. They had these detonations going throughout the columns, and then the building fell down. So I just want to say that the good news is that we can identify this network that is corrupting our government on 9/11, and in so doing, we can identify the network behind 9/11. So with that, I'll turn it over to questions, and we can flesh this out a little bit.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Christopher. I realized very early on into Christopher's talk there that after doing the attendance for 8 years, that the first time I have to do some other duties, I completely forgot that I was supposed to call the roll. So I'm going to do that now, and it will not come out of the Q&A time, I promise. Now, there are three people that joined the call whose names I don't have, so I wouldn't mind getting those. Whose number starts with 210? Oh, wait, sorry, you're muted. My apology.
I don't know how to unmute, actually.
Yeah, you're unmuted now.
Okay. This is Allison Menard. My last name is spelled Maynard, M-A-Y-N-A-R-D. Yeah, and I actually have represented, or at least provided legal assistance to Sandy Hook truthers in litigation, namely Wolfgang Halbig and James Setzer. And I'm really interested in 9/11. And I met Christopher Berlin at the conference on the Liberty. We had we spoke over lunch, and maybe he remembers that. But I do have a suggestion to make, but I know you want to finish the role.
Yeah, I would like to get to that. And so I've got you at 210. Whose number starts with 617?
Bill Wilt.
Okay, that's Bill Wilt. And whose number is starts with 925?
Richard Gage.
Oh, hi, Richard.
Oh, hello, Richard.
Hi.
All right, that's great. So, all right, so let me read then the names that I have. Allison Maynard, Bill Wilt, Richard Gage, Ann Hendricks, Barry Zwicker, Barton Bruce, Kat McGuire, Christopher Boleyn, Sherry Jacobs, Craig McKee, Peter Ketchum, Mike Cook, Marty Hopper, Carl Golovin, James O'Malley, James Hufford, Gordon Bastian, and David Rold. Did I miss anyone? I guess not. Okay, so that part's better late than never, I suppose. So now we're going to do questions and answers, and I'm going to attempt this for the first time, so I hope it works properly. I'm going to go put us into Q&A mode, and what that means is that if you want to ask a question, you have to do *6 on your phone, and it puts you into the queue. So I'm going to just put us into queue. But before I do that, I just want to make clear, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people that are going to want to ask questions. So I would just ask everybody to be as succinct as possible, you know, a lead-in comment and a main question, but not a sort of a long back and forth with any one person, because it'll just take time away from the people at the end. All right, so I'm going to hit Q&A mode now. So that means everybody's muted. So if you want to ask a question, you hit *6. So I'll give people a moment to do that. Okay, so I see some coming up, so that's a sign that it's working at least. All right, well then let's start. The first question is from Sherry.
Hi.
Are you there, Sherry?
Yes.
Yeah, do you want to go ahead and ask your question?
Sure. Thank you, yes. Christopher, on 9/11, Mr. Trump was recorded on an interview on the telephone saying the logical truth that there had to be bombs used. Then on 9/13, in a televised interview with a German reporter, and still on YouTube, he flips like a pancake, and he parrots the official lie to the T. The impacts were so hot, the jet fuel, and if kamikazes are willing to fly into buildings, that's a quote. So I believe that at that moment in time, Trump became a traitor to the United States of America, and he sold us out, and I believe he probably was promised a position of high power. The proof is in the pudding. He is in a position of high power, and he did shut up about bombs. So I've been watching Mr. Green, Adam Green, and No More News, and you've been on there a few times, and I believe what you say, that our government's corrupted. Now, my one question is, of all the people that are in our government and Senate, if you had to guesstimate, and I know you've not researched this maybe, how many of those people were there then? How many people in our government were there that day in our government on 9/11/01. All of those people know. They know jet fuel can't melt steel. So I think we're in a really bad shape now. And even our churches have been co-opted, as the Zionist sniper came to the church down the street from me. You know, and I think that it's up to our military now to take back our government. And I think we should really start educating the military about 9/11 and getting, I'm up here at Camp Pendleton. I already educated 2 Marines that want to get out now once they found out about it. So what do you think about that? I'm sorry to be so long, but thank you very much.
Okay.
Are you there?
Oh, hold on. I think we may have somehow, he might be muted here. Hold on.
Okay.
Hello, Christopher? Sorry, I think you were muted, yeah.
You know? Okay, that's okay.
You're good now.
Well, the thing is that you have to remember that also the media or the military has also been corrupted and controlled by the same people. So there are people in the military that may be 9/11 truthers, but there's a lot that aren't. But the question is, again, you raise a good point. With Trump speaking about bombs in the building on 9/11 and then becoming 2 days later spouting the official story, the question is, who told him, who got to him, who called him on the phone and told him to change his tune, and what was the quid pro quo? Was it office, or was it simply you'll stay alive, or you'll stay afloat, or you will not go bankrupt? You know, there's some leverage they have on these people. You know, from the Epstein case, you know that sometimes that leverage is some vice, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's power. We don't know what they told Trump.
Somebody told him in those two days
to change his tune. And I've seen it before. The same thing with the guy from New Mexico Tech. Van Romero, who is an expert on how buildings survive, or what happens to buildings in explosions, and he's at New Mexico Tech. He saw the explosions on 9/11. He was in Washington D.C. He saw it on TV, and he said he spoke to the Albuquerque paper that afternoon and said that clearly there were explosions and secondary devices that brought down the towers, and he was very sure of that. But then he was silent for 10 days, and then 10 days later he came back and spouted the official narrative that the fires did it, as you know, like Trump did. So the question is, again, who got to Vince Romero and Van Romero and told him to change his tune? Well, it had a lot to do with money in that case. He was in Washington, D.C. to get money for his university, and he got a lot of it. So, but what we can do is we can find out who that network is. Who are those people that made those phone calls to these individuals and told them to change their tune? And by identifying that network, we will identify the people close to the culprits. It's a simple game.
Well, we know some of them, don't we? I mean, Dove Zakheim, he's got to be one of them.
I'm talking about the people. Well, as comptroller of the Pentagon, he may be. He dishes out money from the Pentagon that may have gone to New Mexico Tech. But no, I'm saying we have to find out from Congress people, from firefighters, from police people, from Van Romero. We have to find out from these people who told them to shut up about 9/11 truth. When I talk about 9/11 truth, you know, who told them to stop talking about what really happened and just spout the official line? And when we can identify that group, and that the configuration of that network, we will identify the guilty parties of 9/11.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Christopher. All right. So we're going to go on to Mike Cook. Mike? Oh, is Mike? Let me just make sure Mike isn't muted. Thought this would unmute automatically.
Am I unmuted
Mike?
Now?
Yeah, you're unmuted now. Yeah, I thought that would be automatic, but it didn't happen.
Okay,
so.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, thank you so much for making the call, Christopher. Good to be talking
you.
With you
mm-hmm.
again.
Nice to hear you.
Yeah, it's been a while. I just want to say it's the only good thing I can see of all this is that we, the conspiracy crowd, are considered a large enough voting bloc now that they would pull these psyops to get a whole bunch of us to vote for Trump. And then they follow it up with this Q and four-dimensional chess bullshit, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. the good things that are going on with Epstein and the other pedophilia things and whatnot, everybody or the Trump supporters want to, you know, give Trump credit for. But obviously he's an idiot, you know, a complete clown and a deep state puppet deep in the pocket of Israel. And these are very dangerous times. I don't know what's mm-hmm. going to happen, but I kind of see the walls closing in on them, and mm-hmm. I think they're really scared. So the potential for something really bad to happen is there. I try not to stress over it. There's nothing I can do. All I can do is mm-hmm. my usual thing, put one foot in front of the other. But this is amazing. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I want to say that the good thing, the bad thing. The bad thing is is that obviously the gang that carried out 9/11 is controlling our government to this day. That means that they have controlled the government basically for 18 years. And, you know, that's lock, stock, and barrel. They control the highest level of the departments of whatever, commerce. And so the bad thing is that as long as these people that carried out 9/11 are controlling our government media, bad things will happen. They will not do any good for us. They will not give us our republic back. They will not become peaceniks. They will wage war. They will steal. They will plunder. And they will occupy other lands using our military until we stop them. And that we have to stop them. They're not going to quit by themselves. That's the thing that, you know, really got me going the other day. I was thinking, is that, you know, after following this thing for 18 years, you say, when is this going to end?
Right.
When is this cover-up going to end? And it's not going to end because the people that are behind it are not going to stop of their own volition. They're not going to stop until
we
stop them.
We can't stop either.
We cannot stop what we're doing. That's right. But we can stop them. And the best way to stop them is to expose who they are.
Right on, Bo.
Thanks.
All right. So our next questioner is Bill Wilt. Bill.
Hi. Great to hear you again, Chris.
Thank you.
My peculiar take on it is I call it to tweak them where they live, and to expose some of these folks. So if we were to go after including, you know, not just the 9/11 truth, but things like boycott, divestiture, and censure, BDS, which the Jews used to great effect against Germany in 1933, but are scared to death of it being used in 2019 at sequitur. The Canary Mission, I think they called it. They've got a well-funded website that tries to mm-hmm. smear every person who supports BDS, including Tony. Or, you know, they even make it up. Made it up on Tony Hall. They did this with Tim. Oh God, what's his mm-hmm. name? Tim Evans, who was a professor, black professor at Wellesley, for introducing the book, The Secret Relationship Between the Blacks and the Jews, which is mostly exploitative. And he managed to. He had his own printing press, but basically. And you go after them where the Al Jazeera documentary entitled The Lobby, and there's another one I ran into purely by accident called The Flat, which is about an Israeli, it's the grandson of an Israeli, the aluminum particles are getting to me here. God. But anyway, it's sort of there's an SS officer and there's really. Anyway.
What's your question?
But basically, is do you think that's a really good kind of tactic to kind of try to get under their skin with kind of hit them where they live, mock their, take on Hollywood, take on.
Yeah, well, I think that your point about the BDS movement is very, very good. I mean, it's like, this is what I said earlier, is that our Congress people, I saw the other day, they passed the legislation to oppose BDS. Can you hear me? And the thing is that this is the agenda that they're allowed to, that they're told to promote. They're told to promote the Zionist agenda. They're told to be anti-BDS, and at the same time they're told not to talk about 9/11. Now, like I said, we can identify who are these people. In the media, for example, we know the media is part of the cover-up. We identify who owns the media. Who is the hidden hand that prevents the media from discussing 9/11 truth? Well, the owners of the media. And likewise, who's criticizing 9/11 truth the most? Well, I was attacked by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, in October or November 2001 for an article I wrote about explosions in the World Trade Center, eyewitness evidence of explosions in the World Trade Center. I was attacked by a special memo that the ADL put out. Who is the ADL? The ADL is a wholly owned subsidiary of B'nai B'rith. Who is B'nai B'rith? B'nai B'rith is the secret organization of Zionist Jews in America and around the world. This group, B'nai B'rith, connects the very highest players, people like Michael Bloomberg and Larry Silverstein, and all of the culprits are all bound together in this secret network. Well, I submit to you that this secret network of Zionist Jews plays a very big role in the cover-up. Thank you.
Got it. Well, but the word I was looking for was Zionist. It was the flat is about a Zionist operator and an SS operator back in Germany. They cooked up the exchange agreement where they'd switch out money and send wealthy Jews to Palestine. And they got out about
80,000.
The transfer
agreement, right. I'm familiar with that. Okay. Thank you.
All right, so then we're going to go to Allison Menard. Allison, you're up.
Hi. One thing that occurs to me is going directly to the source. Even though we don't know who those people are, we can get them perhaps by doing something, meaning pass legislation, or maybe it would take a constitutional amendment saying that holders of high public office in the United States may not have dual citizenship. Because when you start looking at the citizenship of many of the people we suspect to be involved in 9/11, including the media, they're dual citizens of the U.S. and Israel. And this is just an inherent conflict of interest. It's divided loyalty. So I think that's a way to cut the root of the poisonous tree.
Yeah. Right.
You know, because our public policy has been totally subordinated to the needs of Israel. That's what we're seeing everywhere.
Right.
But
right.
I wanted to add, too, that, you know, I disagree with you about one thing, Christopher, which is that, you know, the Jesuits are involved. And it looks to me like some kind of a deal was made because the Catholics are in the judiciary and law enforcement. And I wouldn't overlook the role of Rudy Giuliani, but they're all over too, and there seems to be a secret pact among them, and I think you could say it's a pact between the mafia and the National Crime Syndicate, isn't that what it's called? The National, which is the Meyer Lansky group, because they really do cooperate. That's even in Wikipedia. So we have a big criminal thing going on, but one way to get it is end the ability of dual citizens to hold high office.
Right. Well, I would say that can you hear me? Israeli said about this the other day when asked about dual nationality, dual loyalty. She said there is no dual loyalty. Of course, there's no dual loyalty. They're loyal to the state of Israel. If you're a member of B'nai B'rith, your loyalty is to the state of Israel. Full stop. The fact that you live in America is just a detail of life, whether you live in Germany or wherever. So these people are active servants of Zionism and the state of Israel. Wherever, and they conspire in plain sight. And this is the connection between the lawyers and the judges and the people. A lot of people have a lot of hope that the grand jury will bring out some discovery of 9/11. It may not, but it's in the court, the second is the Southern District of New York, where 96 families were sent home without any day in court. This is the court of Alvin K. Hellerstein. They were bought off. The point is that the B'nai B'rith is an organization that does not allow any dual loyalty. Your loyalty is the state of Israel. Full stop. That's who we're dealing with. A secret society I don't know of the Jesuits. There may be some relationship between there's some relationship between the state of Israel and the Vatican. I don't know, but I haven't found any evidence of the Vatican or the Jesuits being involved in 9/11 on an operative level.
It's the courts really. But anyway, so
I understand
I completely agree with you. It's just that I'm thinking about a tool, a way to get them out of government. because if we rely on prosecutions, we will wait forever because they control that.
Well, as you said, I mean, you know, AIPAC should be identified as a foreign organization, and as Kennedy expected, as Kennedy wanted, and they should be required to register as foreign agents. And likewise, there should not be any dual citizens in positions of power in the U.S. government. That should be forbidden, of course. That's just common sense. And pushing for that kind of they have allowed it. They have allowed this to be changed over the period of years. This is what they've done. This is what I'm saying. Our government is corrupted by these people who are covering up 9/11, who are doing things, and they craft the law to suit themselves. Just the same way they crafted $38 billion over 10 years that Obama signed on his last few weeks in office. Okay, thank you very much. Next question. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. You have a question?
Oh, that's me still, yeah. I mean, you can look back further than 9/11. For instance, the BCCI scandal. Who prosecuted that or was in charge? Robert Mueller. And Mueller brought no prosecutions. I mean, Morgenthau, right. Who was the DA of New York, did do something. But, I mean, that was massive frauds involving very high-level officials and, in that case, really Arabs. But also you look at the savings and loan debacle. I mean, what they have done is identified pools of cash and found a way to open them and so the money flows out into their own pockets. And the American public is always the loser.
Yes, yes. We're the loser because we don't have any power. But I would look at Morgenthau's background as well and his father's background before, Morgenthau was no angel.
Well, I know I saw the obituary recently, so I was reminded.
Yeah.
But at least he brought a prosecution from BCCI,
Right.
Okay. All right, great, thanks. I'd like to move on to the next one. We have Mike Cook who's lined up to ask a second question. I'm gonna throw one in of my own just before we get to Mike. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious, it's a bit of a change of pace a little bit, but I was just wondering how you feel about the whole question about what happened at Shanksville. With the alleged Flight 93 and the, the question of, like we were having a discussion recently about the issue of whether, a plane was shot down or not. That's not my particular belief. Mm-hmm. But I was just wondering sort of where you came down on the whole Shanksville part of the story.
Well, I think what the evidence shows, I mean, it's in my book, Solving 9/11, I ended with a lot of that stuff about Shanksville, is I believe that a plane was shot down over Shanksville, but it was not in the mine. That hole in the mine was created by a plane, like a low-flying airplane, like an A-10 Warthog, that apparently fired a missile, an air-to-ground missile that made a little hole in the mine, and that was seen, experienced by a woman driving her van. I forgot her name right now, but she spoke to the British press about the plane flying overhead and hearing the explosion. I think that the debris field, as we know, was in the woods about a quarter mile further. And around the cabins of the Hoover family, Reverend Hoover and his son Barry Hoover, and there, even the helicopter from Pittsburgh News early in the day was filming over that area, and they could just see small pieces of debris. I think the evidence is pretty clear that there was a shoot down. There was a screeching object that came over the golf course and impacted the plane. And that's why the debris field for the plane is quite large. Stuff was found in Indian Lake. Stuff was found in Baltimore. That's a town in Maryland, I think, or in that area. And that's what I think happened. And what I speculate may have happened is that all of the people may have been corralled onto one plane, and that's the plane that was shot down over Shanksville. And that's why, we know that a lot of human body parts were picked up in that area and sent to the Dover Air Force Base mortuary where they were identified. And those body parts that could not be identified were incinerated, cremated, and put in a landfill. All of the identification of bodies was done at Dover Air Force Base by a couple FBI guys. So I think that, the FBI has to answer. The FBI has to tell us what they did in Shanksville, where the debris field was. I mean, these are basic questions. What was recovered, photographs of the evidence, what have you. But that's what I think happened. That's what the evidence tells us happened in Shanksville. Thank you.
Okay. Well, all right. That's interesting. I'd love to ask more about that, but I'm gonna pass on to the next person. We've got a couple more people popped in here. So the next person in the queue is Anne. Want to ask a question, Anne?
Hi, Christopher. Thank you so much for everything you've done, for your perseverance, especially. And thanks for writing a second book. I mean, the volume two, we're looking forward
mm-hmm.
to that. Oh, so my question
mm-hmm.
has to do with Barbara Olson. I'm wondering what percentage of everything is set upon her her person. I've thought about the high visibility that CNN gave her, the
mm-hmm.
alleged invitation to Los Angeles so that she allegedly took the plane, the program
mm-hmm.
politically incorrect, of her husband being Ted Olson, of her alleged words about the box cutters, of her mm-hmm. Longtime involvement with neocons. And in November, 2 months later, Ted Olson was the first one to speak at the Federalist Society. And it was so, so pro-war. And he said, in the present tense, that Barbara understands the need for war. Anyway, mm-hmm. and he also used her full name, Barbara Olson. He would
mm-hmm.
call her Barbara Olson instead of his wife. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
so have you studied, have you thought deeply about what her involvement means? How much has, I'm not sure the right word, predicated
mm-hmm.
on her involvement? I think she's
mm-hmm.
as visible as Larry Silverstein.
Mm-hmm.
So Ted Olson spoke the first talk, and Dick Cheney spoke in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
my feeling is that the people in the Federalist Society, Judge Bork and others,
mm-hmm.
are deeply involved in this. If anyone wants to read those transcripts, they are posted on the Federalist Society, and I highly recommend you at least read the first one, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. Well, what have you
mm-hmm.
thought about her?
Yeah, well, I've written a little bit about her. She's a high-profile victim. And then, you know, he wound up marrying a woman that looked very much like her from Kentucky. But I think that the information that we have from Barbara Olson, I mean, directly, it came through a phone call, right? A phone call that she made from the airplane or something like that. And this these phone calls are a very, very interesting aspect of course, the whole 9/11 mystery. And I'm just, in proofreading my second volume, I read the article about Ari Fleischer that I wrote. Ari Fleischer is a man I met when George Bush was running. He was basically the guy running George Bush as a candidate. And he's his brother was working for an Israeli company in New Jersey called Bogen, B-O-G-E-N, which is all about phone instant voice messages, all this kind of voice recognition, etc. All this use of voice on phones and the technology to record and to all that. And this is what the what I think the Israelis did is that they have they had companies that dealt with this. They were able to get voices of these people, and in some cases, perhaps in her case, she may have been a willing player in this, like you said. It may be a complete hoax. She might be part of the hoax. I don't know. But the phone calls themselves were a hoax. And there was an agency that was expert in telephony that was behind that. And I think that Ari Fleischer's brother, with the Bogen Company in New Jersey, played a role in that. So there were people like Ari Fleischer who were clued in. And knew about 9/11 before it happened, and who was really behind it, and those are the people that have to be investigated. You have a very good question, a very good point. I'll look more into the Ms. Olson's connections. I'll read that bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay, our next person is Carl Golovin. Carl, go ahead.
Christopher, thank you for being here. I was pleased to meet you sometime back in a D.C. 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
event
mm-hmm.
where I did raise a question with you about whether all of this is really traceable just to, quote, Israel, or what is
mm-hmm.
the role of the most powerful entity in the world numerically is probably the Roman Catholic Church. And in response to the early question about Jesuit Association, I wanted to reference three books just briefly, and the notion that, you know, the New Testament, especially the best translation, William Tyndale's 1534 translation, which refers to the congregation of Christ rather than the, quote, church, describes that, you know, they're the influence of the, quote, Judaizers or the circumcision group as being in opposition to the pure gospel of Christ. And I tend to believe that the Roman Church and since then, of course, all the Reformed denominations have at some point been infiltrated and co-opted and used ultimately, as we find in today's world, to support Talmudism, which is essentially Judaism, which is Phariseeism, which is exactly what Christ, you know, demonstrated and taught and in his crucifixion most strongly opposed. So
right.
I find myself less likely to use the word Jew or Judaism anymore, because when one realizes that the governing document of, quote, Judaism is really the Talmud or the Babylonian Talmud, I guess, in particular, and that there are a lot of pretty horrifying things in that. And it's caused me to have greater empathy for those who purport to be Jews or Judean, because I think they've been spiritually led so far astray and to be essentially part of a cult. And when one's entire social experience revolves around being part of that community, and there's a lot of pressure to be part of that community and only view that as your only loyalty, it creates empathy. And so anyway, but briefly, back to the Jesuits. Thomas Harris, Brigadier General Thomas Harris, who served on the military tribunal that investigated Lincoln's assassination, published a book in 1897, a brief text titled Rome's Responsibility for the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And I would recommend a 2014 reprint of that by Green Mountain Publishing, which includes as an appendix conversations between Abraham Lincoln and Charles Chiniqui, C-H-I-N-I-Q-U-Y, a former Roman Catholic priest, close confidant of Lincoln, who was adamant as to Jesuit involvement even after Lincoln's assassination in that very event. Maybe the central text, for years I've focused on the Jesuits, not really thinking beyond them to Talmudism, but Rulers of Evil, subtitled Useful Knowledge About Governing Bodies by Frederick Tupper Saucy, S-A-U-S-S-Y, first printed in 1999, again in 2001, which essentially traces the near 500-year history of the Jesuits and their entanglement, even in the founding of our republic, the breaking of the colonies away from Britain. Lastly, a text that I have not delved deeply into, but the title I think is telling. It's written by a Jesuit scholar, Robert Marykes, M-A-R-Y-K-S, titled The Jesuit Order as a Synagogue of Jews. And, of course, in 12 or so hundreds and such, there were a lot of false conversions, compelled conversions of those who were Jews in Spain, and it was out of Spain that Ignatius Loyola came.
We do need to move to a question, though.
Okay.
Just to tie it off, that was to introduce the text about the Jesuits.
Yeah. Okay, the point is well taken. I understand that the church has been infiltrated, and I mean that happens. Anybody, any large body of people is going to get infiltrated by people of hostile opinions. I mean, the Catholic Church is not alone in that. 9/11 truth communities are infiltrated by people who want to cause dissension and break up the effectivity of the group, the effectiveness of the group. But I want to remind you that 9/11 is a crime, and we're looking for the criminals involved. We're looking at the people who are involved in the crime and people who are involved in the cover-up of the crime, because the people involved in the cover-up are part of the crime. You know, I understand Jesuits and these old infiltrations, what have you, but that's not the point. The point is, who did 9/11, who's covering it up, and can we find them out? Can we expose them? And if they happen to be Jesuits that are warning the Congress people not to talk about 9/11, we might find that out. But all the evidence that I have found thus far indicates that this is a Zionist group. And Zionism is not a religious group per se. Zionism is, of course, a political ideology, a nationalism, and an agenda. And that is who I have found. And the people that I have found operating secretly behind closed doors are a secret organization belonging to that group called B'nai B'rith. If Jesuits turn up in the search, I'll let you know. But I don't go looking for Jesuits when I don't find them. Thanks.
Yeah, briefly, just one comment. William Binney, who was with NSA, I had the opportunity to ask him whether, if there were any U.S. people involved, politicians, military, whatever, in the false flag aspects of 9/11, would NSA have captured their electronic communications, their calls and such?
Mm-hmm.
And Binney said, absolutely yes. The question is whether they'll ever be allowed to look at them or not. And he pretty said that NSA probably has the evidence, and they've been not allowed to look at it.
That may very well be. But, of course, there's a lot of communication that went on between Israelis and whatnot that does not go through the NSA. They have, you know, that's what secure channels are all about, having communication channels that are not listened to. Is there any more questions?
Yeah, okay. So we have please nobody else join the queue at this point. I see we have three people that are looking to ask a second question. And if we do that, I have Kat, who has not asked a question yet, and then I've got Bill, Allison, and Mike who want to ask questions. The latter three, could you just make it a really quick question and not a comment, and so that we can, because we do have to move to our next speaker who is with us and ready to go. So let me just go to Kat. Kat, you're up.
Okay. Hi, Chris. This is Kat.
Hello.
Hi. My question is with the breaking open of the whole Jeffrey Epstein scandal, we see Ehud Barak, among many others, getting focused on. Do you think in any way all the stuff that's going on, 9/11, and somehow can come out of the Jeffrey Epstein fallout?
Yeah, it could very well. With Ehud Barak being photographed at the door of his penthouse there in Washington, New York, one of the questions, a lot of people like to think that the Epstein thing is being run by Israeli intelligence. I wonder about that, because Israeli intelligence would not likely want to expose their most decorated soldier, Ehud Barak, as being involved in pedophilia or whatever in that house. I think that the whole Epstein thing is most likely British intelligence / Rothschild. I think it's a Rothschild operation, probably in the first degree, because they need to have agents and people that they can control, and this is a method of control. You know, you get a person blackmailable and you control them. So I think that yes, if Ehud Barak is involved in Epstein case, then 9/11 is by definition involved in Epstein case, because Barak is one of the key players in 9/11. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, can I jump in and ask? Somebody joined the call. I have Ted having joined at nine with a 917 number, but I got another 917-406. Who's that? Oh, they're muted. Okay, who's got the number 917-406?
Ron Tishman, can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yes. I do. And yeah. Good to have you with us. So now, all right. So we have two people that are asking a second question. So obviously, make it as brief as possible. And the first one is Bill Wilt. Bill.
Chris, there's one thing I didn't say in the spreading conspiracy, and that is the Cyanim, this hidden group, and then the ones that Allison Weir brought out was the Perushim, a very, very secret thing run by Brandeis. Have you kind of come across those, or do they figure in any way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The Cyanim are, of course, the people who live in America, for example, is Jews who are supporters of Israel, who are willing to give help to an Israeli intelligence operation like 9/11 because they want to support Israel. And so if they have some way to help, they help. The Perushim, I don't know that I've heard that term before, but the idea is the same. People who are willing to help you know, in Israeli operation. But I want to say one thing about Zionism. Zionism has always operated with secret societies. If you look in the history of Zionism, particularly in the Encyclopedia of Israel and Zionism from 1970, just read the chapters about secret societies. They created secret societies in order to make Zionism work in Eastern Europe. There was the Lovers of Zion. There were the B'nai Moshe, B'nai B'rith. These secret societies function for a reason secretly, and that is to advance the Zionist agenda. Thank you. Next question?
Wow.
Okay. All right. So our last question for Christopher is Mike Cook. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to chime in on this Jesuit thing. I think it's a smokescreen. I think it smells like Mossad disinformation. There's been nothing turned up on it, and, you know, there's always looking to deflect. I was contacted by a professor at a university, Jesuit university here. He contacted me, and I went to see him at the university, met in his office. He wanted to know all about 9/11 truth, and I was laying it all out, controlled demolition, architects, engineers, all that. But, you know, come to find out, he was getting death threats and hate mail and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
That's what contacted me. He wanted to know what was going on. He wasn't really any help. He was about to retire, a very elderly fellow. But I reassured him that the actual 9/11 truth movement is not after the Jesuits, and we're not going to assassinate anybody or anything like that.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's a good point. That's a good point. Like I said, I work from the evidence. And I work from the logically from the evidence, what the evidence shows me. And, you know, the fact that Mayor Giuliani happens to be an Italian Catholic does not mean that Italian Catholics are behind 9/11. I think Giuliani probably had actually any role at all, just a minor managerial role where he was advised. If you look at people like Rudy Giuliani, all of his lieutenants were Zionist Jews, all of them. And the people that made the decisions were all Zionist Jews. And you have to understand that Giuliani had a skeleton in the closet. That was his father. His father was a hitman for the mob. And that was did not come out until very, very late in the game, that this was made public. Because that's what they had on him. They had this, and so they controlled him with this sordid history of his father. So I agree with you. As I said, if I find evidence of Jesuits, I will certainly let you know, but I haven't found any yet.
Right. I agree 100%. And the organized crime ties are large.
Yes. And the organized crime ties, like somebody said earlier, is the crime syndicate. I grew up in Chicago. We called it the crime syndicate. That's what the media always called it, the crime syndicate. Who was the crime syndicate? The crime syndicate is the Jewish syndicate, not the Italian syndicate. In Chicago, they never talk about the mafia or Cosa Nostra. They talk about the crime syndicate because the crime syndicate was run out of Chicago and was headed by people like Sidney Korshak and all these high-level Jewish people from the west side of Chicago. I mean, it's always been the case. But what they tried to do, just like with the Jesuits, they tried to make it look like for the American people that the organized crime is an Italian thing. The Italians are secondary in the hierarchy. The runners of the operation have always been Jewish. Thank you.
And they control Hollywood and they make movies about it.
Yes, Sidney Korshak. Sidney Korshak got Al Pacino the role in Godfather and made sure that the guy, the fixer, Tom, was portrayed as an Irish German, when in fact he was in fact Sidney Korshak. That was Sidney Korshak, the role played by Tom, and Sidney Korshak is a Lithuanian Jew from Lawndale, Chicago. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Christopher. Thank you for your presentation and answering all those questions for us.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. I want to say that I've been writing about this lately, but I will do a full piece article for my website, Bolin.com, about how we can identify the people behind the cover-up. And that's where we have to go, because the cover-up is, like Nixon said, it's not the crime that gets you, it's the cover-up, because the bad guys expose themselves in the cover-up operation. And that's all to be seen by, and that's, I'll write about it on Bolin.com. And if you haven't read my book, 9/11, it's a good place to start. Thank you.
Great. We'll get your website and the book mentioned in the minutes for sure. So Great. So you're welcome Go ahead.
Also the book, The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East, which is a very so that people can understand the relationship between the War on Terror and 9/11. They're two sides of
right.
the same coin.
Okay.
Thank
perfect.
You very much.
Perfect. Thanks a lot. You're welcome. You're welcome to stay with us for the rest of the call if you like, or not, as you wish.
Okay. Thank you. I'll probably go back to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh gosh. Okay. Great. Thanks
okay,
so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye bye. Okay. So the next item on the agenda. We have with us from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, we have Ted Walter, who is the Director of Strategy for the organization, and he did an article this week that you can find on the A&E website, and I won't tip what's in it because he's going to tell you all about it, but it contains some very interesting and extremely good news for the 9/11 Truth movement. So are you there, Ted?
Yes, I am. Hi, Craig.
Okay, great. I'm gonna put this into lecture mode so we can block everybody else out except you. Hold on 1 second. Okay, so everyone is muted. Now I just have to unmute Ted if I can. Where is he here? Hold on. Okay, now that's weird. Where did he go? Oh, okay, sorry. Found him? Okay, so I'm just unmuting you now. So you're there, Ted?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So why don't you take it away?
All right, thank you. Well, thanks for having me on the call. And the news that we wrote about in the article that we published this past weekend, I assume many of you have read it, but probably not everybody. There's a fire district in Long Island in Nassau County, just outside of Queens, that passed a resolution last Wednesday calling for a new investigation into 9/11. Specifically, the resolution is supporting the grand jury investigation that was initiated by way of the Lawyers Committee filing the petition last year with the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. And the resolution that they passed also, you know, broadly supports any other efforts than any other government entities would undertake to, you know, get to the bottom of what happened on 9/11. So this community of folks, I mean, the fire district, you know, basically serves a town of about 30,000 people in Nassau County. Many, you know, almost everybody that lives there works in New York City. The town lost several people on 9/11. The fire district, the firefighters in that fire department were very involved in the cleanup at Ground Zero. They were also called in on the evening of 9/11 to actually cover for the Queens, because all the firefighters in Queens were down at Ground Zero. So, and they did lose members of their department, at least one member of their department, on 9/11, and a couple other residents who were firefighters, working for the FDNY. So the commissioners who passed it, there was five commissioners, and they basically oversee this fire department, and it's a volunteer fire department, so the firefighters are not getting paid, but they spend a lot of time training and putting out fires and whatnot. This is obviously a really positive development, because it is, you know, a government entity, and it's, you know, it's people who were directly affected by 9/11, you know, people who were essentially victims of 9/11 or co-victims, if you like. And we hope, and I know that they hope, that this is the beginning of something much larger. As far as I understand it, it is their intention to try to mobilize the entire fire service community within the state of New York, or certainly with, you know, downstate New York, to get on board and, you know, calling for a new investigation. So one way of doing that is by trying to get other districts out there in the New York area to pass the same resolution or a similar resolution. And they do have, you know, they do have plans in store to have representatives, at least one representative of architects and engineers, come and present to fire commissioners and fire chiefs from all over the state at, you know, major events that they held, that they hold every quarter and every year. So I think that they envision a sort of timeline of, you know, of a couple of years of working to, you know, really a grassroots movement of trying to get the fire service completely on board and supporting a new investigation and, you know, using their voice and the fact that they were sort of made the heroes of 9/11 to, you know, in a way start a revolution of first responders and see where that goes. We've been in touch with this department for maybe a little less than 2 months, and at some point they informed us that they were looking to pass this resolution. And, you know, so we were ready for it when it happened and ready to report on it. And we are looking forward to, you know, working with them. We, meaning architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth, are looking forward to working with them, you know, right away in the near future to keep the ball rolling. It's likely that we'll be participating with them in a series of events. One event in the New York area. Hopefully they will be organizing a meeting of fire commissioners and fire chiefs from all over Nassau County, where we will be presenting around the 9/11 anniversary. If we can't manage it for then, it will happen at some point, but hopefully around the 9/11 anniversary, we're trying to put that together quickly. And some of them will be coming down to Washington, D.C. with us on the 11th, probably for a press conference and what we're calling a political action day. Where we will be doing what we've done the last couple of years, which is, you know, go into the Capitol, go into Congress, have meetings with members of Congress or their staff that we can get meetings with, and give our literature to every member of Congress. But this year will be really exciting because we will be, you know, walking the halls with all of these fire commissioners and fire chiefs, and we're really busy trying to put together the whole day. So the point of all this is to say that the group is obviously taking a very courageous step, and they're not just sort of like hunkering down and waiting to see what happens. And, you know, they're very open to working with us and apparently working with the movement in general, and but also working within their tight-knit community to get the word out and mobilize folks. So that's the story in a nutshell.
All right, great. So I'm going to put us into Q&A mode here. Okay, so anybody that would like to ask Ted a question can do *6 as you did last time. While we're waiting for somebody to do that, I'll ask it something, Ted. Now Ted is muted. Well, this is fun getting used to this. Anyway, so you're unmuted now, Ted. So I was just wondering, do you, and maybe you said this in your talk, and if I missed it, I apologize, but what was the sort of, I mean, I know, I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but part of the impetus for this particular fire department was that they had one of their own people die on 9/11. So I'm just wondering, was that kind of what really started them down that path? And I guess part two of my question would be, do you think that the New York area is really kind of ripe for this catching on for that reason? Because those fire departments would have a much more personal tie to what happened than ones, in other parts of the country might.
Right. So, yeah, I think a major driving force behind this is the fact that they did lose a member of their department on 9/11. The firefighter's name was Tommy Hetzel. He was a full-time member of the FDNY, and he was also a volunteer member of the Franklin Square Fire Department. And, you know, all of these, most of these commissioners knew Tommy Hetzel before he was, you know, before he died on 9/11. They knew him for, you know, probably met him at least 25 years ago. So it is very personal for them. I think that they realize, and, you know, beyond that, you know, they spent the first year after 9/11 going to, you know, funeral after funeral after, you know, and so on. And they go to memorials every year, like 9/11, you know, the first responder, you know, experience of 9/11 is very much still alive for them. They live it every year on 9/11. They live it, many of them live it every day, because some of them are the thousands of first responders who are suffering from being down there working on the pile and, you know, inhaling the toxins that were down there. So, you know, including actually two of the commissioners. In my article, I only mentioned one of the commissioners, and I tried to get this information before publishing the article, but I learned that another one of the commissioners actually is also quite ill. So it's very personal for them, and I think that they actually believe very optimistically that, you know, when the, well, first of all, from their sort of, you know, chatter with people in their community, they feel like a significant percentage of the community already knows that something is wrong with the official story and is supportive. And I think that they feel that when, if the information can be presented in the right way, in the right settings, that, you know, pretty much that they'll have a really high success rate in terms of quickly convincing people, you know, of what is very obvious to all of us. And that because of the personal, you know, obviously sometimes a personal connection to it can make somebody like even descend even further into denial and delusion and whatnot. But I think they feel that the particular their people in their community kind of don't go for that. And, you know, when they see the obvious evidence in front of them, when it's presented to them in the right way, that they're going to get it and they're going to be really upset and that they're going to be ready to take action. Especially now that one department has already sort of blazed the trail, and hopefully more will be doing so in the coming months.
So, yeah, I was just wondering wondering if, you know, the bigger departments, you know, they probably have more people that have been affected in terms of their health or being killed on that day. But I'm just wondering whether the fact that this is a smaller fire district, whether that sort of made it a little bit easier for them to maybe be the first to take this step. Maybe they feel more able to do it than a larger one does. Do you think that's the case?
I can't say for sure. It's possible. I'd be, you know, speculating that, you know, I don't know what the different sizes of the districts are. There's actually an incredibly high number of fire districts in Nassau County, something like 50. Nassau County is a big county, but there's a lot of fire districts. So there's a lot of these apparatuses of governance. It's kind of almost amazing how much governance they put into running one small fire district. With that in mind, perhaps, you know, the environment is really ripe and sort of perfectly primed and to like have many of these districts pass similar resolutions. If they get, you know, they get a critical mass of people on their commissions, their commissioners, supporting the cause. The other big question mark is the FDNY. As I've sort of learned over the last couple months of talking to these folks, pretty much every fire department outside of New York City is a volunteer fire department throughout New York State. But the FDNY is obviously a professional fire department. And so the simple fact of the matter is that members of the FDNY have much more to lose. And I think we all kind of understand that that has probably been a driving force in keeping that community mostly silent about what happened on 9/11, what they experienced, and so on. So as the momentum grows outside of New York City with the volunteer fire departments, with individual members that maybe have less to lose by speaking out, or are less intimidated, how that momentum kind of transfers over and spills over into New York City, where, you know, you have the FDNY, whether members of the FDNY begin speaking out, whether there becomes some sort of organized following within the FDNY, will remain to be seen. I think that there will probably be a sense of solidarity in general, if this goes where we hope it goes. But at the same time, the folks, even some of the folks in Franklin Square, one in particular, is very friendly with the head of the firefighter union of the FDNY. And, these conversations are happening all the time, and, who knows what kind of traction they might be able to gain relatively quickly, even with not the leadership of the FDNY, but the leadership of the union, which is almost more important when you're talking about trying to mobilize firefighters at the grassroots level. I know that they have a lot of connections as well. The entity that really kind of helps oversee and like facilitate all the volunteer fire districts throughout the state is the State Association of Fire Districts of New York State. And from what I understand, the leadership of that organization is actually quite supportive already. And so we'll see if that organization in time becomes something of a player in the whole effort.
All right, great. Well, we've got a couple of people in the queue here to ask questions. So first, Mike Cook, you're up.
Hey, thanks. You can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks so much, Ted, for everything you've done. It's Mike Cook here. I just wanted to impress upon you an angle that I came across indirectly. We have a memorial here, and every anniversary, they have a gathering, and we go out. And there was a number of years ago where all of the men, like to a man, all the fire guys were not taking it, or if they took it, when they found out what it was, they'd hand it back to me, which was cool, instead of throwing it in the trash or punching me in the face or whatever. But their wives were interested. Their wives were interested because they were concerned about the safety of their husbands. And so I think that's an angle, kind of underhanded a little bit, but it's something to keep in mind that might work. And this is a very encouraging development. I hope it spreads like wildfire. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, that's a good point. And, I think that, one thing to remember is that, like, behind every firefighter who died, we tend to think of, like, first responders in one bucket and 9/11 families in another bucket. But all the first responders who died on 9/11 have families. And as we see in Franklin Square, the family of Tommy Hetzel was there at the hearing, at the meeting, and is fully supportive of what the fire commissioners did and is fully supportive of the cause. And so, one thing to try to focus on is, not just the individual members of the fire service, but their families, and the families of the people that died on 9/11. Of course, that's always been a focus of the 9/11 truth movement. But it can be a really beneficial focus, in terms of mobilizing folks. And it's not just the members of the fire service, it's their families, it's this entire community, and wives and women and daughters and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole family, the kids, it's like the firefighter fathers would hand it back to me, and the wives would come and take it. I want to see it. What's
yeah.
it say? But yeah.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And for example, I don't know anything about this. Like I haven't asked about this, but like I learned from looking at the pictures of Tommy Hetzel at the at the meeting last week that he had a daughter, like a baby, you know, on around 9/11. So a lot of these people that died, these firefighters may have kids now who are maybe in their late teens or 20s, you know, and who knows if they might end up getting involved as well.
Right. Thank you.
That's a place
to
focus.
Great. And our next questioner is Ann Hendricks. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. Thank you, Ted. That's very exciting, everything you've shared. I like the words revolution, and I like the picture of you bringing the first responders with you when you visit Congress on September 11th. That's fantastic. I did watch the video of their resolution when they were reading it. My question is, I'm up here in Minnesota, and the other day I met somebody last week who he said something about my job, and I said, well, my real job is I'm a 9/11 truth activist. And he said, that was my building. I worked there. I worked for the New York, the Port Authority of New York. And so I told him about this call and invited him to come today, but I'm hoping to get his story. But I don't know, would that be something, you know, who would he tell his story to? And I think that every person can be useful in some way. Would there be anyone at A&E to whom he could talk, to whom he could tell his story, to provide contacts or information on other folks who worked for the Port Authority thought also, because maybe he could mobilize old coworkers. Do you have any idea who would be interested in hearing his story?
That's a good question, Anne. Let's start, you know, I would say the first thing is to find out what his story is and kind of how willing he is to tell it. I think definitely if he witnessed things happening in the building, explosions and so on, or being outside of the building after he evacuated, if there are things that he could talk about that he experienced that would provide additional evidence of how the buildings were actually brought down, that would certainly be something that we at AE would, you know, potentially be interested in writing about and documenting. It is, in a way, interesting to me. I don't know if I've followed every possible story that's out there, but, you know, for all the people that were there and the awareness of the 9/11 truth movement that must exist by this point, you know, there must be lots of people with these kind of stories. And in a way, it's a little surprising that they're not, coming out and telling them more. Obviously, this is maybe overall a very traumatized group. But, you know, so this kind of story, it may not be like an earth-shattering story from an evidentiary perspective. But if there's any insight that he can give of what he experienced that furthers the case for controlled demolition, and he can also add a human angle to the story, I think it's probably worth covering. So if you do talk to him and his story kind of fits that profile, you could contact us or you could encourage him to contact us.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, he did believe it was an inside job, so they may have felt that for a long
good.
Time.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Good. So yeah, that you know, somebody like that speaking out could be helpful, even if he didn't witness anything. The story could still be of interest.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. We have one last question, and then we'll move on beyond that. But we have Sherry to ask the last one, and Sherry, you're up.
Hey. Hi. Thank you. This is Sherry. I first want to thank you for all the work that you're doing. Very much. And there used to be firefighters for 9/11 Truth, and y'all did some videos with Eric Lawyer. I was wondering if that's still in kind of active and if he's still around and maybe could help with, you know, with what's going on right now with this.
Yeah, good question, Sherry. So I actually got an email from Eric Lawyer today asking if he could publish the story on his website. He does have sort of a new, and other folks might know more about it than I do, but there is sort of a revitalized, to some extent, and rebranded version of the organization that you started maybe 10 years ago, Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. They do have a website. I think that's where he plans to publish this article. And so it, you know, it was great to hear that he heard the news and that he was really overjoyed by it and wanted to publish it on their website. You know, I think it's a good question as to whether that group, and I don't know how functional it is, it's a good question how much that group could interact with the firefighters that are organizing in New York. There, you know, it's perhaps certainly from a certainly Eric has done a lot of research and put a lot of thought into the issue and like how the issue is relevant to firefighters and how firefighters, you know, sort of from a fire protection and a fire investigation standpoint, should look at the issue. So I think that maybe the materials that Eric has developed over the years could be really useful to the folks in Long Island. And so I would actually, yeah, I'll take a look at his website and I will talk to them about that when I, the next time I talk to them and just look at the materials that Eric's developed and see if any of it, I think any of it could be useful. From an organizing standpoint, it's hard to say. I'm sorry. Because this community is like.
Unity is where it's at. If we could unite, if you could maybe unite those guys, that would be stronger than not uniting them.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, yeah, I think that they should, you know, certainly I think it makes a lot of sense for Eric and the folks and the people that are active with Eric to talk to the folks in New York and see what opportunities they can come up with. To a large extent, it's about the folks in New York organizing and utilizing and, you know, within their already existing network and their tight-knit community that they have.
Eric,
you know,
what state is Eric in? He's in a different state?
I believe he lives in Seattle or in the Seattle area, unless he's moved.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. That's the end of our questions and answers for that item. I'm just going to take us off of... Okay, everybody's unmuted now. So Ted, thank you very much for coming on, especially on short notice and telling us about this. And we really appreciate it. You're, as always, you're welcome to stay for the rest of the call if you like, or not, as you choose.
Thanks, Craig. It was great to come on, and thank
all
you
right,
all for being
thanks
here
so
and
much.
Participating in this.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. All right. So we have our third speaker, and I'm going on memory now because I think I've got this right. Kat, are you introducing our third speaker?
No, I'm not.
Oh, darn. You're the only name that came to mind, and now I realize
Craig.
I should have written this down.
Craig,
Ann. Oh, it's you, Ann. Okay. Excellent. Okay. That was painless. All right. So, our third item is Carl Golovin, and to introduce Carl is Ann.
Hi. Okay. Thanks, Carl, for being on. Carl Golovin is a retired special agent of the U.S. Customs Service. He worked 17 years in South Florida before reassignment to Virginia Internal Affairs Field Office in August 2001. For 3 weeks in November that year, as one of many customs personnel assigned as 9/11 responders, his primary duties included sifting rubble of WTC-7 that was brought to the Fresh Kills landfill. Upon leaving the government, he volunteered for and was then hired as a security director of Ron Paul's 2008 presidential campaign. A native of the Washington, D.C. area, he is an advocate in every respect for government transparency, and his domain reference is www.anidealivson.net. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you. And
actually,
I guess
Carl,
my
Carl, just sorry,
yes.
Just before you start, I'm going to put us into lecture mode so that we only have you live, and then I have to unmute you. Give me 1 second to, oh, here, there you are.
Thank you, Craig.
Carl,
I hope you're
all set. Go ahead.
Thank you, and I hope I don't give you cause to mute me during my talk. I apologize for having gone on a little bit long and referencing some text during Christopher's talk, and I wish he had stayed on. I wanted to make one point concerning, he's talking about the cover-up of 9/11. Well, the best evidence of Jesuit Roman Catholic involvement in, quote, the cover-up probably is in Vatican II. I've just recently discovered, I'm not Roman Catholic, so it took me a long time to stumble on this. Vatican II evidently ordered all Roman Catholics to henceforth treat all Jews as their brothers. And there seems to therefore be a uniting against Islam and, you know, the carrying out and protecting of those who perpetrated the false flag event to demonize and go after, to radicalize Islam and facilitate greater Israel, beyond which I don't know what the deal is between the Israeli spiritual leadership and the papacy. But thank you for allowing me to digress there. Tonight I'm supposed to speak to a text, which is really astonishing that it's almost a suppressed awareness in our country. The Iron Curtain Over America, written by John Owen Beatty, B-E-A-T-Y, and it can be found, as many other even banned books can be found, at the UNZ Review, UNZ, which I believe domain reference has been provided to link to the text. John Beatty served in World War I. Thereafter, in 1926, he, under a grant from the Albert Kahn Foundation, which was out of Paris, Albert Kahn having been a wealthy banker, he was given funding to travel the world and write about essentially what he found to be the state of world affairs. And he visited some 29 countries in the course of doing that. As World War II was approaching, he was brought back into the military, served in military intelligence, and in the course of his duties interviewed thousands of businessmen, military people, traveling in and out, mostly returning from Europe, in developing his analyses. He was part of preparing what was called the Daily G2 report that went to the White House and other top officials. And it summarized world events literally up to the last 4 hours. So clearly in a prominent position. And after he left, after World War II, he wrote this book in based on the collectively all of his experiences and information he received. He found in his travels around the world that the state of affairs was often quite different from what the impression we were given back in America was. And he begins his book with a chapter on the Teutonic Knights and Germany. And this is drawing the larger, longer time frame of global conflict that has brought us up to 9/11, and that being Talmudic Zionism being implicit in that, dating back, in his writing probably he points back, well, primarily 100 years, but even going back 1,000 years. And the Teutonic Knights were essentially the spiritual entity in the area of Prussia that was so strong prior to World War I, such a strong Christian society, really the bulwark, I guess one would say, of Western Christianity. And this, I'm going to digress into referencing Benjamin Friedman, who is himself referenced in Beatty's book. Friedman, 71 years old in 1961, converted from Judaism to Roman Catholicism, gave a talk in Washington, D.C. at the Willard Hotel. 1961, he's 71 years old. He'd been prominent in the Wilson administration. And he begins to speak about how Germany just had to be brought down because it was too strong, too powerful, and the Talmudic Zionist interests were evidently in the midst of this process whereby the French, Russia, and Britain brought war to Germany. And at that point, prior to World War I, Friedman says that Jews had it the best in Germany of anywhere in Europe. There was no discrimination. They had absolute equal civil rights. And the most prosperous industrialists and bankers in the world were based in Germany, as was the Zionist movement. And quickly, the British were on the ropes. Germany had them very close to defeated. And according to Friedman, the Zionists of Germany went to the British War Cabinet and said, look, you don't have to agree to these very favorable terms of surrender the British are being offered by Germany. We can bring America into the war, and you can destroy Germany. You don't have to settle. All we want is the promise of Palestine and your influence to make Palestine our national commonwealth after the war, if you're victorious. And of course, that all happened. Now, Friedman, and this is astonishing. Everyone should listen to his audio recording of this talk found at archive.org. He was among the small world delegation of Jews who was in Paris for the settlement talks after World War I, when Germany is being carved up and you know, the huge reparation payments are being imposed. And he says it was only at that moment that Germany, the Balfour Declaration, was unveiled and the Germans first became aware of it. And, of course, it sent repercussions through Germany that all of a sudden Jews were, their businesses were shunned by Germans who felt they'd been betrayed to their destruction by these people who to whom they'd been very welcoming for a long, long time. So now Beatty digresses there into also saying that when the Weimar currency collapsed, that there was a lot of resentment in Germany because Eastern European Jews in particular came into Germany, bought up assets, driving local German people out of business, and this enhanced the resentment. But there was still no violence, he says, against Jews until, I guess it would be 1933, at the depths of the Depression. Jews in Germany were suffering, and it wasn't tolerated by the World Jewish Conference or Congress, which held a worldwide conference, and out of that declared, quote, a holy war on Germany to take the form of a global boycott of all German goods and any businesses that sold those goods. And, of course, this, strengthened Hitler's hand, which he took advantage of. There was tremendous resentment. Who are these people seeking to economically, utterly destroy Germany? Now, Beatty would argue, and he argues that, this long movement towards Talmudic Zionism, implicit in that is the destruction of Western Christianity centered out of Prussia, hence via World War I, World War II. And also he points out, and this is the first, I haven't heard tonight, reference to the Khazar people. And this is a fairly recent discovery of mine in the last year, the notion that the majority even of people who purport a Judean ancestry, even in Israel today, maybe 90% or 95%, genetically, family lines are not traceable, cannot trace themselves, are not traceable to the Levant region. They're actually, their roots are among a Turkic people that established themselves around 700 AD, a warlike nomadic trading, people involved in trading in the area between the Black and Caspian Seas. And at that time, they were pagan, being forced, compelled on one side by Byzantine Christianity and on the other side by Islam to convert and submit to one of those two hierarchical authorities. And their king evaluated the options and decided, we're going to adopt Judaism. And I guess promptly the top 4,000 of the king's people, the men were circumcised and the rabbis were brought in from, other areas, and they adopted Judaism. And eventually they were driven out of that area by 1100 AD or so by the people of the Rus, later became Russia and were a Christian people, Eastern or Orthodox Christian. And the Talmudized Khazars or Judaized Khazars, millions of people, very focused on their religion, probably not even realizing that they don't have any original ties to the Levant. They've just adopted this system of living. They settled in primarily Eastern Europe and parts of Russia. And ever after, there was tension and hatred between the Talmudized or Judaized Khazars and the people of Russia. This is written about I'm told, in the book, by the last book, even, of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, which, amazingly enough, is one of the books he's... It's few books of his that have never been translated into English. And it's titled 200 Years Together, A History of the Jews in Russia. And it's interesting, one raises in conferences in D.C. this question of, well, wait, these people aren't actually Semitic who are so adherent to the Talmudic system of teaching and have established Israel, taken it from the Arabs who lived there peacefully for nearly 2,000 years. It's not a welcome question, but it's very important. And Beatty does a fantastic job of painting the broader picture and also in great detail. Now, I do want to just reference one quote that ties in, believe it or not, I think in theory, the Kennedy assassination. You know, we know that John Kennedy opposed Israel getting nuclear weapons, that he favored maintaining strong relationships with the Arab countries. He also wanted the Jewish lobby to be registered as a foreign agent. But beyond that, looking at the Kennedy family history, here quoting from page 87 of Beatty's book, a chapter titled The Unnecessary War, which is how Churchill described World War II, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who during World War II was Secretary of the Navy, recorded in his diary that he was told by Joseph P. Kennedy, the U.S.'s ambassador to Britain, that Prime Minister Chamberlain, quote, stated that America and world Jews had forced England into the war, World War II. Now, of course, Forrestal, in a book, The Assassination of James Forrestal by David Martin, a fairly new text, I first learned that, yeah, Forrestal was close with not only the elder Kennedy, but John Kennedy, who was in his late 20s in 1945. Forrestal, as just Secretary of the Navy, was not officially sent to the Potsdam settlement talks near the end of World War II, but he traveled there at his own expense, and he took John Kennedy to be an observer of what was going on. So you have to believe that John Kennedy had instilled in him, and Benjamin Friedman personally met with John Kennedy. John Kennedy understood the roots of Talmudism in the leading of the Western countries into World War I, as well as involvement in World War II, in order to secure Israel as their property. And so one can see that Kennedy was of less utility as president, whereas Johnson had actually facilitated. There was a PhD dissertation by a man named, last name Gomolak, G-O-M-O-L-A-K, who was at the University of Austin. 1989, he wrote a PhD dissertation about LBJ's indoctrination to foreign policy from, I guess, the 30s up till 1948 or so. And he says Johnson was well embedded and very close with the Zionist community in Texas, and facilitated, leading up to World War II, much immigration into Texas of Eastern European Jews, who were, of course, very loyal supporters of him. Now, follow this. On the 24th of November, 1963, while in Texas, you know, with Kennedy, Johnson was supposed to have stayed and helped speak at the dedication of a synagogue. I believe it was in Galveston, might have been in San Antonio or Austin, one of those cities. And, of course, that was canceled when Kennedy was assassinated. But literally the very first public speech Johnson gave a week after the assassination, he returned to Texas and spoke at the dedication of the synagogue that was led by a prominent Zionist. And, of course, we know Johnson was there to have the crew of the Liberty silenced when that false flag went awry in 1967, which would have drawn the U.S. into expanding the Middle East war, blaming the Liberty attack on Egypt, presumably. So back to Beatty. I think I would just encourage everyone to please go to the UNS review and just read the introduction, read the background of what John Beatty is, and take it from there. I think you'll find yourself enthralled by the text, which had been through, by 1954, it had been through 12 printings, and it is still being currently printed. You can buy it on Amazon. And the ADL actively wrote to some military people who were recommending this book. Very high-level military people endorsed it. So there is an awareness historically in the U.S. military of the broader scope of these issues. And one of those generals actually wrote back to the ADL and told them to, leave them alone, that this is a great book. So and the last point I just have to introduce, recently discovered book Judaism discovered by Michael Hoffman in 2008, which gets into the history of Talmudism. And two texts on one can't to understand who's perpetrated these events. One must follow the money, and A History of Central Banking by Goodson, and The Lost Science of Money, an absolutely comprehensive text by Zarlinga. They tend to both reinforce each other. The prior text has been decreed as anti-Semitic, whereas Zarlinga was invited to speak at the U.S. Treasury after he wrote his book. So thank you for letting me digress. That's it.
Okay, great, Carl. I'm going to unmute everybody. I realize now that Cheryl was with us there, and I didn't even notice until Carl had got going. Now, Cheryl, you're still muted. Do you hear me? Did you mute yourself?
Yes. Hi. That's why.
Sorry, you're breaking up kind of badly. Are you...
I'm in the car, so it's probably hard to hear me.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to carry on then? I was going to hand it back to you. Do you want me to?
Yeah, okay. Please do. Thanks.
Okay, great. All right then. So we're going to go into question and answer mode. Let me just do that now. So everybody is muted now. So if you would like to ask a question of Carl, star 6. All right, so we have our first question, so we will go right to it. Kat, you're up.
Yes, about Benjamin Friedman, he was certainly a valiant person to come forward and bear all. Do you have any idea what happened to him? I mean, he certainly would have been considered traitorous, but I never heard that he died funny. How was he allowed to continue living after he came out in such opposition to his tribe?
Oh, wait, let me make sure. Carl may be muted. I'm sorry. Hold on one second. My fault there. Carl, now unmuted. Did you hear that question?
Yeah, I did. Thank you. Yes, I think Friedman lived a full life and was not murdered, nothing like that. Now, he did spend a good deal of his fortune supporting a... newspaper that was published in the Washington area, I think it might have been called Common Sense, that was primarily focused on being anti-communist. And Friedman advocated everyone, he said Congress was bought and paid for, there's no point in trying to write to your congressman. That was 1961. He said the Zionist lobby owned Congress then. He encouraged everyone to try to contact Kennedy. By the way, I forgot to mention James Forrestal, who, close to the Kennedys. Came out as being very concerned that Zionism was going to become a political football between the two political parties, Democrats and Republicans, rather than being kept at a diplomatic level. And, of course, Forrestal was found to have gone crazy and was, although he'd left his position, was a private citizen, was essentially forced to be held at Bethesda Naval Hospital on the 16th floor for close to 2 months, I think, before he Feller was pushed from the 16th floor and of course, you know, reported as a suicide. So another staunch opponent of Talmudic Zionism who didn't fare well. But Friedman, I think, lived out his life primarily focused in his writings on opposing communism. He was invited at one point by a military officer to speak at, I believe, a graduation of the U.S. Marine Corps Academy. And somewhere I found a copy of the text of his commencement address to the Marines. So that another astonishing moment of insight given to our people in the military.
All right, great, thank you. Does anybody else want to ask a question? We have no one in the queue, but if you would like to ask a question, then please hit star six. Were you finished, Kat, with anything you wanted to ask?
Actually, can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Sorry, there's a siren in my neighborhood. Sorry about
yeah.
that.
Well, there's various theories about who actually killed Forrestal. Do you think it was the Zionists? I'm trying to remember who all else had it out for him, but it wasn't just the Zionists. But I think it's the Zionists. But what do you think?
Well, and I'm inclined to think even the Roman Catholic Church and many of the denominations have been well infiltrated, co-opted, and led down the path of supporting Talmudism and Zionism. So if one wants to go with the notion that back to, and I'll go in a round circle here, the Talmud, several thousand pages, apparently is a very legalistic, almost a law document, and it contains elements of what one would call casuistry, the steering of one's thought processes through suggesting hypotheticals or cases, you know, in order to go from the imagined to a generalization. And, of course, the Jesuits are well known for their casuistry and their circuitous reasoning. It's okay to lie if in your own mind you're holding a mental reservation that you're under no obligation to tell the truth at the moment you make a statement, things like that. And for its founding, the FBI was heavily populated with people out of Jesuit schools, for them in particular. And the FBI clearly seems to have been in the thick, of course, covering up Kennedy's assassination. Who knows who was killing off witnesses. I think they're, I don't know. I don't know who would have, there's some speculation in this book by David Martin, The Assassination of James Forrestal. It's a new book, just came out in 2019, that there may have been another person on the 16th floor but has a naval hospital positioned as a patient who was just given an opportune moment. I think one doesn't know. I've wondered, of course, at the highest levels of the CIA, James Jesus Angleton was the sole liaison in contact with the Mossad. And yet he is found to have been holding Oswald's, quote, 201 file, which meant Oswald was essentially an agency asset being maneuvered into the position of being the patsy for Kennedy's assassination. And yet when Angleton passed away, a memorial was built to him in Israel, and all the intelligence and military people gathered to, give honor to James Angleton. So I wonder, to what extent even was our CIA well infiltrated or co-opted from early on, from its inception? Of course, they're not supposed to kill people domestically. I recall an audio or video recording in the Guilty Men series of a military assassin saying that, well, the mob was brought in to do things that, you know, that the military and intelligence could not do domestically. But as far as, it's like 9/11. I don't know how we get to the actual persons who perpetrated something. You know, one would tend to think Kennedy's assassination, whoever did that, they themselves were probably disposed of soon thereafter. So I'm sorry to have gone around the corner there rather than directly to an answer with you.
No, that's okay.
Okay, great. So that's the end of our questions. Thank you, Carl, very much for your presentation.
Thank you. By the way, I wanted to share, there's a saying, I guess, in maybe it's the history of air combat, that you know you're over the target when you start getting hit by flak. and I've had two experiences. For 5 years, I've long been a student of monetary history from a constitutional perspective, and I've attended for 5 years in a row, up till last year, attended the Cato Institute's annual monetary policy conference. I'm on the videos of asking many questions about monetary policy. Well, before last year's conference, I simply recommended as a must-read this book titled A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind by Stephen Mitford Goodson. And I was notified that anyone who recommended that book wasn't welcome at the conference. And sure enough, they knew who I was, and I was blocked from entering the conference that year, and I'm actually banned from all Cato Institute events just for recommending a book. And wow. A similar experience just in the last, this last weekend. For 3 of the last 4 years, I've attended the annual conference of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. It's snapnetwork.org is their domain. I was never Roman Catholic, never experienced any abuse of this nature, but I have been a student of also the hierarchy, the history of the Roman Church and the Jesuits, and I did find fellowship in participating in and donating to and supporting these conferences, and have always been welcomed. And yet this year, on the Friday evening that began the event, it's always been exclusively a Gentile event, mostly Roman Catholics. But this year, conspicuously, there were several individuals dressed in black and white with the skull caps. I'm not sure what they're called. Signifying that they're Jewish, I guess, conservative by their black and white attire. And in the context of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, Roman Catholic priests being the big deal, I found this interesting. I went up to ask them because I had heard that the Talmud speaks forgivingly or favorably of sexual relations between adults and children. And very quickly they actually acknowledged, yes, the Talmud does say that. But then within a short time I found that they had gone to the head of the entire event and stated that they were offended by my conversation with them. And lo and behold, by the next morning, they brought Westin Security to ask me to leave the Westin Hotel, to leave the conference. So I guess I must be close to a sensitive or the root of things to have these experiences. I did respond by actually writing a two-page letter that references some of these texts and the circumstances that I would be very pleased if it were uploaded and available as a PDF at the Deep State Crimes website. I can send that on to you. I went back and handed it out to many people in attendance as they came in and out of the hotel.
Yeah, if you send that to me, Carl, we'll get it to Ann to put in the minutes.
Thank you. Great.
All right.
May I make
Thanks.
A comment? I'd just like to make one, a very, very short one. The guy who wrote that book on central banking, he died funny. So he was recently, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think he did die young, just within the last couple of years. His last edit of the book was in 2017. It says New Edition in the upper right-hand corner of the cover. And I don't think there's anything in his book that isn't recounted in Zarlenga's very exhaustive but more politically correct in its wording, History of Money and Banking. And Goodson, of course, was a director of the Reserve Bank of South Africa, so he understood banking as a banker would. And, this is also of interest. Now, in the depths of the Depression, there were two countries that decided they were going to do what Lincoln had done with the greenback and just create government money to build housing and put people to work, rebuild industry. And those countries were Japan and Germany.
Huh.
So they surely were not with the game plan as far as central banking and you know, what we by then long had had as our Federal Reserve, the third central bank of the U.S. So following the money is key, and who of course controls the money is reasonably well known.
All right, great. Thanks,
Thank
Carl.
You.
Appreciate
Thank you.
It. All right, so I'm going to take us off Q&A mode.
Hello?
All right, so everybody's
Nita.
Unmuted.
I wanted to make a comment. Can I make a comment, Nita?
Yes, so go ahead.
Yeah,
Nita.
I just wanted to say that Angleton, as I recall it, created the Mossad in Rome immediately after World War II, and he was the head of the Israeli desk in the CIA. But he was the creator of the Mossad.
I suspect that the Mossad, people that formed the Mossad, have kind of been doing their thing for a while. But,
yes, but he actually created it as the Mossad. I mean, he was
okay.
The person who went to Rome, and they had a meeting, and that's where they set it up immediately after World War II.
Wow.
I don't remember where the reference is, but that's what I understand.
Well, right,
so
I guess within within Talmudic Zionism, if anyone, I think this is a quote attributable to the person who assassinated Rabin, and this quote is from the front pages of Michael Hoffman's book, Judaism Discovered. Just a moment. Here it is. This is a quote from the assassin of Yitzhak Rabin. Quote, according to Jewish law, the minute a Jew betrays his people and country to the enemy, he must be killed. No one taught me that law. I've been studying the Talmud all my life, and I have all the data. This was reported in the New York Times, November 27 of 1995.
Okay. All right. So thanks again, Carl. So we're going to move to announcements. I mean, we do have a spot usually where we see if anybody wants to suggest any possible guests for upcoming meetings. We do have a very open one in August. But I'm going to suggest that maybe if anybody has any suggestions that they just email Cheryl or me or both of us, or just because of the time. Because we still have to do announcements. So if anybody's interested in presenting on anything, August would be an excellent time to do it because we've got an open agenda so far. So besides that, let's get to our last item, which is announcements. Does anybody have anything they would like to announce? Is that a no?
I have a question, Nita. Is there going to be anything in New York on September the 11th?
Well, yeah, there is, and I thought we might even have we might even hear some stuff about that tonight. But I thought we might have Barbara Honegger on, and she was going to talk a little bit about things she was involved in. But I'm not personally able to answer that question, but maybe somebody else is. I know there are things, but does anybody on the call know details of what's happening in New York?
Well, it was in the minutes that David Meiswinkel and Andrew Craig are working on a lawyers' committee event either in Washington, D.C. or in New York City. So they're the ones to connect with, or Barbara.
Right. Excellent. Thanks. Thanks, Anne. I'm sure we'll have a lot more about that next call. I'm sure somebody will be talking about different events that are going on in the August call for sure. Okay, anybody, any announcements?
This is David Rold. I have sort of an announcement or a topic idea. I'm running for president in the Green Party primaries for 2020. And
oh, great.
So I'm for 9/11 truth. My position is that people close to the Zionist regime and the U.S. regime did it, and that Muslims are not responsible for the 9/11 attacks. So, you know, I could possibly do 10 minutes sometime on one of the calls.
Hey, David, what district are you running in? Will.
I'm running for U.S. president in the Green Party U.S. primaries.
Oh, president. Okay. I'm running for Congress in the 5th District, Massachusetts. Is it write-in?
Okay. Yeah, that's no, that's my district. So.
Okay. I'll vote for you if you vote for me.
All right.
Does that mean, David, that you're running for the Green Party nomination? Is that what
exactly.
that means?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, great. All right. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
And I'm running on the preamble party, which takes as its plank the preamble of the Constitution.
All right, great.
David, this is Ann. I think that's fantastic because it seems that you running for president have the most opportunity for free speech. The rest of us can talk 9/11 truth and be shut down. But because you are running for an office, and that is going to be your platform, it's awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, same here. Welcome.
Great. Any other announcements? Oh, okay. I guess hearing none. I guess that brings us to the end of our call. I'm just making sure, searching my mind to make sure I didn't forget something, but I don't think so. So that's it for our call. If anybody has any ideas about presentations, let us know, and David will communicate with you before next call, see if you want to do something.
I'm just trying to figure out my schedule for the date of the next call. I'm not sure yet, so.
Okay, well, we can...
August 28th.
August 28th?
Yeah, okay. The date is August 28th, yeah.
Great. Okay, so I guess that brings us to the end of the call. Thanks, everybody, for being part of it. I think we had a really interesting call tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
And we look forward to seeing everybody again, or here talking to everybody again in a month. Good night.
Thanks, Craig, for taking over tonight.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.